This is a recording from CSIS. To help us improve our content, please take our short survey located at csis.org/survey.
Moscow Center. Vladimir is one of Russia's best-known energy experts, but he has acquired a relatively new profile and interest in politics, so he's here today to talk to us about that. What is going on with Russian politics? I'm kind of intrigued by the title of the talk, Vladimir: Russian Politics: A Chance for Change. There's no question mark.
There's always a chance.
Okay. With no further ado, let me just thank you for joining us here at CSIS and turn the floor over to you to the chat and tell us how big of a chance there is and what you are intending to do.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Andy, for giving me the floor in particular. And I just thought this would be a good opportunity to share some firsthand views about what's going on in Russian politics from the alternative point of view. I understand you just recently had a very big official delegation here, including President Medvedev. And I think it would be probably good to have some kind of alternative follow-up to that. This is my third day this time in Washington, D.C. I've had already very many meetings and been asked a lot of questions, so I think I probably know what the key questions are about what's going on in the Russian politics at the moment. So I'll just try to briefly run through the most important points and maybe leaving more time for a Q&A session to have some kind of an informal discussion about what's going on. And of course, when we talk about change, it's quite clear that we have passed a decade of development of one particular political system. Its features, I think, are very clear. And the legacy also becomes clearer and clearer. My vision can be found in the book which we recently published with Boris Nemtsov, which can be freely found on the internet, which is called Putin 10 Years, and there is a special website dedicated to it. Unfortunately, it's only in Russian, but I think it's... I saw that some people already have the translations here in Washington, D.C., and I know that a lot of you speak Russian. So basically, it's quite clear that we're at the end of a certain era in Russian politics, and even those people who see the results of this era as quite positive, contrary to what myself and Boris Nemtsov suggest, they also admit that there is a time for some kind of change, and we need to move on. Something which was actual just several years ago basically requires rethinking, revisiting. You hear President Medvedev speaking a lot about the need to modernize Russia and so on. So there is this, even among the establishment, Russian political establishment, there is a wide recognition that something needs to be done to move forward from the system which we have been building over the recent 10 years. A lot of people are excited about the idea that Russian politics may change sometime in the future. Some of them think that this change might come from above. The authorities will be driving certain developments, positive or not, but they will take the lead. There is the other view on the situation, which gives more role to the civil society and the Russian public, which have been quite passive and apathetic during the recent period, basically giving the floor to the authorities to reshape and redesign Russian society and Russian political system. I try to give you a view on different angles of the situation. The government, the society, what the opposition is doing to trying to influence the situation, and also I will take a few notes about what is the Western role in driving the need for Russia's change. Now, to me, the need for change is obviously evident because largely in the recent decades, we have been not moving anywhere. And particularly, I'd rather say that the consolidation of power which was the super idea of the Russian politics of the recent 10 years, didn't lead us anywhere. So it turned out to be... I'm not going to follow up very much on that. Many experts have already commented on this. But during the first years of Vladimir Putin's presidency, the idea of consolidation of power was largely viewed positively by the society and even among those Russians who have more liberal and open-minded views about how the society should look like, because a lot of people thought that this consolidation would provide the authorities with the ability to drive society somewhere. Now, unfortunately, the results which we can observe after this decade is mostly that consolidation have happened. It had many different negative consequences for freedom of speech, freedom of expression, many other civil and political liberties. And there's a new report by Freedom House released, which I was part of a presentation of here in Washington yesterday. And I think these negative dynamics are well known. But we haven't been particularly moving anywhere in terms of solving the country's basic problems, from modernizing the army to reforming the pension system to building the transport infrastructure. This modernization talk, what strikes me is that it's happening in Russia right now as though we didn't have this 10 years where we've had a very favorable circumstances, including the oil export revenue windfall and recovering of the economy after the post-Soviet depression. And other positive circumstances. The authorities try to present the case like, you know, we have to start from anew, turn a page and move somewhere, like we didn't have this 10 years of opportunity. Unfortunately, what is missing here is a good analysis what could and should have been done during this past decade. This analysis, which myself and Boris Nemtsov suggest, basically gives the idea that if the current system is preserved, that we're still going to be stagnating for an undetermined period of time. And despite a lot of talk about the will to modernize Russia, we're not going to move anywhere. Particularly following up to the President Medvedev's visit to America, I have to say... that we got to be absolutely clear about the fact that Russia is already entering a new federal election cycle, which is not going to be something revolutionary because political system is tightly controlled, and the outcome of this new political cycle, the federal parliamentary elections of December 11, 2011, and presidential elections in 2012, I think the results will be pretty much decided. And please don't expect some major breakthroughs in Russian politics in connection to that. But it's naturally a period where the authorities start to be more populist and refrain from taking a risky and potentially painful moves towards changing the economic, social, political system under the slogans of long-term modernization or whatever strategic goals the government is announcing. So if there was a period to do something, if Mr. Medvedev is sincere about his talk about modernization, and if there was a period to do something relatively smoothly without the need to appeal for a general public with certain populist motives, it was these 2 years, which have already passed after Medvedev was sworn in as president in May 2008, and it's not now, because from now on it's quite clear that the government would be naturally quite cautious in terms of radical reformist moves because of the need to be more populist because of the upcoming elections. But unfortunately, I think it's also quite clear that these 2 years have been wasted in terms of making anything serious towards any kind of serious steps towards modernizing Russia. There's been a lot of talk about the resolution of certain specific problems, particularly Medvedev have taken on the corruption issue. But I have to say that everything has gotten worse since the recent since Medvedev was sworn in as president in terms of corruption and Our joint report with Nemtsov basically focuses on that. The biggest chapter there is dedicated to corruption, and not just a plain and well-known figures about the degradation of Russia's position in the Transparency International Index, but we also use multiple other indicators to show that the situation with corruption have gotten worse. First is the official Russian statistics, which show a slight decline in the rates of recorded crime over the recent couple of years by nearly every type of crime except bribery, which spikes. Yet even another important indicator is that there is evidence and facts which we show, facts reported by not just the official media but the Russian authorities as well, that there is vast corruption related to all the recent mega projects from Sochi Olympics to building Eastern Siberia Pacific oil pipeline. So basically all the major investment projects pursued by the Russian government in the recent years were plagued with corruption, something unexperienced before, because in the previous years we didn't have that massive investment efforts by the Russian government. And once they began, it's quite clear that the effectiveness of those efforts was seriously contained by corruption. Another indicator is development of a system of multiple and systemic conflicts of interests, where you have close relatives of certain high-ranked officials benefiting directly from their regulatory activities. And this is not just the number of cases. It became widespread. It became a system where major officials on the federal and regional levels and local levels basically are using their position to provide economic benefits to firms associated with their relatives. It's not only the case of Moscow Mayor Lushkov, but it's on a terrible scale the case with federal officials. Just very recently, the son of Patrushev was appointed the head of the fourth largest bank in Russia, Rossilkhozbank, which is an agricultural bank. The sons of major officials, be it Chemizov, Sergei Ivanov, Matviyenko, all of them are occupying high-ranked positions in state-affiliated companies. So there is this, you know, it's a very structural issue, and it's something totally unexperienced neither in the 90s nor even in the Soviet era. The Communist Party leaders with all my negative attitude to them never allowed themselves to give so much direct economic benefits to their relatives from their rule as the present authorities do. And the problem is that despite a lot of talk about the need to tackle corruption, nothing is really being done about it. And like we say in Russia, the fish rots from the head. This attitude, this tolerant attitude towards obscene cases of corruption on a very high level of Russian politics basically delivers a signal throughout the society, like if Lushkov is allowed to get away with it, then why shouldn't we try? And for instance, there's been a lot of evidence, including those submitted by a high-ranked Russian politicians, part of the official system, like Zhirinovsky, had appealed to the president complaining about corruption in Moscow city government. There was no reaction. Lushkov still works as he did. And Medvedev just very recently, in January, had reappointed for the third term the governor of Primorye in Vladivostok, Mr. Darkin. I think I need not to further comment on his reputation, but it's indeed a very clear signal throughout the society that such actions and such tolerance towards these corruption cases basically extremely devalues all the official, you know, goodwill talk about the government's understanding of the need to tackle corruption problem. So the value is brought down to zero by a lack of action in such an evident cases. I mean, you take anything which President Medvedev tried to tackle, independent judiciary. It was one of his topics when he just became president. The situation got worse. And he was also promoting the idea that he's the champion of assisting the medium and small-sized businesses and What we got instead is increased administrative pressure on them, plus the increase of taxation from January 1st, 2011, which is for sure unwelcomed by medium and small size businesses, and actually would play a very destructive role for the Russian economy. So again, without further ado, I would simply question the sincerity of the intent to change anything described by the Russian authorities, and particularly President Medvedev, who is considered by some as a potential leader of these changes from the top. Obviously, there is a question of whether Medvedev is, although with all these problems which I just had outlined, even Medvedev is very likely not here to stay for a long period of time, and we have discussed with colleagues here in Washington for the recent couple of days about what's the chance that Putin will return to the presidential throne, if you will, in March 2012. It's still very highly possible. I will be happy to give more comment in the Q&A session about my personal opinion of this, but I think this issue is finally undecided, but there is only one party who will make an ultimate decision. It's Putin. It's not a matter of negotiation. If he would make a decision to come back, he will, indeed. And there is nothing virtually that will be able to stop him from doing so. Medvedev, during the two-plus years of his presidency, was not even able to change the head of his own administration in the Kremlin, which he apparently tried but failed. And other examples include potential efforts targeted to replace the Minister of Interior, Nurgaliyev. These attempts were also not successful because Mr. Putin had protected Nurgaliyev's position quite well. And the case with Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov is another example of president's actually inability to do something. So it's quite clear that Medvedev is administratively and bureaucratically quite weak. And he's not in a position to challenge Mr. Putin and to have an equal dialogue with him about who is going to bid for presidency in 2012. At the same time, I have to say that Putin largely remains undecided on the issue so far. He's inclined, as we have seen from past experience, and Andy knows this very well, that Putin is very much inclined for this last-minute solutions, or let's say last-minute disclosures, to be precise, right? There is no sign of specific detailed preparations for his potential comeback. This is still left as an open issue, and I think in the coming months we'll be expecting a final decision on this. To me, this doesn't make very much difference whether Putin comes back or not, as long as the system remains in place and Putin remains an influential part of the system. If it will be that way, it means that it doesn't really matter that much who of them will occupy the presidential seat. Although I have to say, the difference here is that it's quite clear that if you try to, of course, please don't take this as me advocating Mr. Medvedev in any way, but it's quite clear that you can distinguish between them very easily. When they talk, when they deliver speeches, articles, whatever, in their actions, it's quite clear that Medvedev is much more oriented towards the future and how he sees it. His kind of strategic vision and agenda for Russia's future. There is a huge disconnection between what he says and what he actually does, and the lack of understanding how to get to this bright future that Medvedev depicts. But he still likes to talk about the future, the rosy future of Russia. Putin doesn't like that. He mostly 100% talks about the present and the past sometimes. It was very remarkable when he had this annual traditional direct line with Russian people, like 4 or 5 hour staged performance on the first channel of TV last December. When he was asked a question, it was a very remarkable moment, and I advise those of you who are interested to get back because it's all available on his website. There was a question from some girl, a student from some Siberian university, who said, "Vladimir Vladimirovich, how do you see the future of Russia in 20 years? And he skipped. I mean, he just gave a couple of formal phrases and moved to the other question. As he seemingly was not interested in describing the future. He's rather very happy to describe how many billions of rubles was allocated for some kind of investment program at some other machine building plant or whatever. Rather than talk about strategic future of Russia in 20 years. So it's quite clear that the crossroads is that Putin really more looks like a man of the past, and his comeback would provide a greater likelihood of a longer-term stagnation for Russia. But this is very much truly so, even if he stays as prime minister or in another important position influencing the decision-making. Also, I have to say that my personal feeling is that a lot of members of the official establishment, quite loyal to the present system, also doesn't want Putin to come back because they see Medvedev's presidency as some kind of window of opportunity, I'm not talking about issues like modernization, change, future, and so on, but for some kind of personal self-promotion because Putin's comeback means a totally locked-up situation, complete lack of vertical mobility within the system, and basically the same, 12 to 15 individuals moving from the post of head of State Duma to the post of Minister of Interior to the post of head of FSB. And it's quite clear. We all know about Putin's personal appointment policy. He trusts a very narrow circle of people. So his comeback would mean a very bottled-up situation and no opportunity for self-promotion for major part of the establishment, which looks cautiously about the potential for Putin's comeback. But at the same time, please don't take these people at the establishment as the group which can attempt in anyhow to stage a revolt. So this is rather to me it looks like a bunch of lambs waiting whether they will be sent to a slaughter or will have a better destiny. But in any case, this is not a group which can substantially influence the situation. Now, there's the other player, important player in Russian politics, which have been quiet for quite a while, which is the Russian society. It's been quite passive and apathetic, which was the part of the big deal with Putin during the recent 10 years. The deal simply looked like... Look, I guarantee that your lives will be improving, and in return you give up your political and civil freedoms. Yet even another point of that, very important, was that Putin had created a system which did provide a lot of personal, individual freedoms and liberties for people not connected with political and civic liberties. Like, you're free to travel, you're free to move all over the country, you're free to open your business, free to change your jobs, free to sell and buy apartments. This is something drastically different from the Soviet period and gives the authoritarian system a much more flexibility. People enjoy it. People enjoy that the government does not interfere in their daily lives. Although they hit the wall now and then in terms of the need to face corrupt bureaucrats and so on, but there is still a great extent of personal freedom, which is something that pretty much keeps Putin afloat and popular. And this is something which I have been arguing here, which is some people found a relatively fresh thought. My two and something years in the radical opposition politics tell me that... One of the basic conclusions is that the human rights agenda, as we know it from the past decades, is not particularly popular with the Russian society, because this is not something which sort of clicks in the minds of the majority of the people as something relevant to their daily lives. Human rights agenda is seen as... Protecting some distant minorities, which bears no relevance to the majority of people in the Russian society. So This is why I have to say that I understand that a lot of previous opposition politicians in Russia and a lot of Western institutions are focused on human rights agenda as a potential tool for change in Russia, but I don't see any perspective for it, frankly. It's not popular and doesn't have a chance to become popular. People just don't care about the rights of certain individuals being oppressed. You can see it quite clearly in the Khodorkovsky case and others. So it's an important agenda, but it doesn't have a chance to win a major popular support. But what is happening, however, is that the society is slowly, but I'd say surely, starting to wake up, because the contract, life improvement, economic improvement in return for giving up political rights has been breached by the authorities in the course of the economic crisis. And a lot of people have actually felt various economic and social difficulties and troubles, because not only because of the crisis, but also because of the anti-crisis policies of the government, which includes actions that have significantly worsened the economic situation of many of the social groups. You see the protests here and there sparked by either increase of import tariffs on cars or increase of the road tax. I expect there will be more because of the failures of the pension reform, because of the budget constraints and the fact that despite the remaining inflation, the government had decided quietly not to increase salaries for people who work in the budget-financed sphere, which is very important. This will play out. There's going to be a major increase in taxes, as I mentioned, from 2011. So there will be more social groups affected, and there is no easy recovery down the road in terms of the economy. I wouldn't go very much into that. Maybe you'll have questions. So a lot of people basically are starting to feel discontent with the present system. This is, of course, sparked by the economic crisis. Some had expected that the crisis will have a very quick result in terms of really massive demonstrations demanding Putin to go. This didn't happen, but it's starting to happen right now, not to the extent that some people hope, but there is certain movement in that direction. We've seen mass demonstrations, particularly in the Russian regions, in the beginning of this year, which began, as somebody mentioned during one of my meetings in this recent couple of days in Washington, with the plain bread and butter issues. But they're very quickly sparked into a really highly politically charged protest. People have easily and willingly accepted anti-government and anti-governor slogans. Particularly, I have to say that this protest, I have been part of the three of these demonstrations in the regions in Kaliningrad in January and March. I personally was there. And in February in Irkutsk, where I was also speaking. And I have to say that, believe me, 100%, these were very politically charged, very anti-Putin demonstrations, something we never experienced before in the recent years. And I think it's clearly the beginning of certain process of awakening of the society. However, I have to warn that those who expect that it's going to happen like landslide and it's going to be very rapid and influence the situation, political situation, very seriously, I don't think that there's a need to be so optimistic about it. It's a slow process, but it works. And also, what is important is that this process is much more active in the Russian regions this time than in Moscow, which is kind of a new feature for the Russian politics, totally. And there are some regions which seem to totally disobey with the current system, quite important, like Irkutsk, where you see fifth consecutive defeat of United Russia in mayor elections, or Yekaterinburg, where you also had a mass demonstration, something totally unseen in more than a decade. 6,000 people gathered on the 10th of April in Yekaterinburg, and United Russia had received a crashing defeat out there in March in the parliamentary, regional parliamentary elections. It got less than 40%, which is an absolutely, you know, record-breaking result for the recent years. Actually, we have every half a year in March and October, we have the set of regional elections all over the country, which basically demonstrate a continuing decline in support for United Russia, even due to falsified official numbers. Last year, I tried to run as a candidate in the Moscow City Parliament elections. I was, like any other independent candidates, I was banned from registration on ridiculous grounds. But what we did with my colleagues was an absolutely invaluable exercise, something you don't even have in the opinion polling systems. We have went through, I'd say, more than 10,000 residential apartments of Moscovites in my district, and we just talked to people, me and my assistants who help to gather signatures in support of my candidacy. And believe me, we have met almost zero support for United Russia. And United Russia still has somewhat 50-60% approval rating according to official polls. But I have to say that the approval ratings for certain individuals, particularly three people, Putin, Medvedev, and Lushkov, is still indeed very high. I'd estimate that according to our exercise, not only that in Moscow, but in Sochi elections in April, I'd say that maybe not 70 or even 80, but I'd say above 50% personally positively evaluate these three individuals, but no one supports United Russia. So I think all the support that United Russia gets the elections from here to there means that it is derived from using the administrative resource rather than support of people. People view United Russia as a bunch of useless bureaucrats who are parasites on the body of the society. This attitude is becoming institutionalized, and it's very important. It's very important because it's a sign of an outright rejection of a system by the people. So the fact that the shift in the society opinion, I think, right now is that even those who are very loyal to Prime Minister Putin or President Medvedev, they are more and more admitting that they don't like the system which was built, and the system is moving us nowhere. So I'd say I see the perspective in that in developing social and political activity in the regions, particularly where there's a clear connection between the abolishment of governor elections and these recent either mass protests or defeats of United Russia, or relative defeats on regional elections, because Yekaterinburg, Irkutsk, Kaliningrad, Samara, Arkhangelsk, here is where you have regional governors appointed completely from the outside, not being familiar with the region, not being part of the regional elite, actually doing a very unpopular moves, being unable to settle up the issues in a civilized manner with regional elite and regional population. So it's quite clear that, and it's a direct correlation between that and mass supports or United Russia defeats on elections. So it's quite clear that the system of transfer to governor's appointments instead of elections had proved out to be a complete failure. So in any cases where the old governors have not been reappointed, most cases you see the tensions between the society and the government like that. So there is some kind of process of awakening up of the society. I assume it's going to take longer time because the government still has the resources to tackle the financial crisis, although they are shrinking rapidly. Despite the oil staying at $75 a barrel, roughly, during the first half of this year, Minfin's reserve fund had shrunk from above $60 billion on the 1st of January to less than $40 billion on the 1st of June. It's going to be eroded completely in several months, even if the oil stays at the present levels. But still there is some capacity in the system to contain these protests, and yet they are developing, I'll be happy to further comment on this. Now, what the opposition is doing, I think we have, instead of the previous attempts, we have achieved certain success in the recent couple of years because the opposition have transferred from the general agenda of complaining about how bad things are in Russia, unfortunately, sometimes more frequently in Washington, D.C. than in Russian regions, The opposition have transferred to some practical activities. We did have certain very successful campaigns, election campaigns in the regions. We have appealed. We have focused on appealing to grassroots. We have traveled all over the country. For instance, I have visited about 40 regions in the recent couple of years, and my fellow colleagues Boris Nemtsov and Ilya Yashin also visited about that number. We do have a lot of meetings with ordinary people. We try to focus on enlightenment and propaganda efforts, and this sometimes prove themselves quite successful because the book that we issued last fall about corruption in Moscow city government associated with Lushkov and Baturina family, we had issued it in 200,000 copies and distributed it freely all over the city of Moscow. Under our estimate, each sixth or seventh family of Moscovites have seen this book. This had a visible result on opinion polling and a decrease of the popular rating of Lushkov. I can comment further on this, but we are searching for new methods of enlightenment and propaganda which help overcome the barriers and constraints with regard to access to federal media that the government is imposing on us. So we try to work this out. It doesn't go without difficulty. We have a lot of internal difficulties in the opposition. Particularly, I think what is the most difficult part is that there is a great demand for renewal, for attraction of the new people into opposition to replace the old leaders. There is also a need to broaden the range of our active supporters, which is still relatively low. And you see, for instance, on the example of these demonstrations in Moscow, it's basically the same 300 to 500 people which travel from one street gathering to another. We need, and there is my experience tells me that there is a great demand for. A new effective liberal democratic political force in Russia, but you really need to routinely work with people and dedicate a lot of resources to just that. Not all of the opposition leaders really understand it. Some of them disregard very important instruments of appealing to grassroots and to voters. For instance, I see regional and municipal elections as probably the best way to attain people's interest in politics in general and opposition in particular. But unfortunately, some colleagues, like Garry Kasparov, for instance, and his supporters, they completely oppose any participation in the elections on the ground that this legitimizes Putin's regime, which I think is maybe it's true from purely perfectionist position, but it's not particularly helpful. We need to reach out to people and use every instrument that is available there. And I think elections is probably the best instrument which we can't afford to miss. Although we do meet a lot of all sorts of administrative resistance and we are frequently banned from participation, but it's still a chance to communicate with people which we cannot miss. So just to finish, I just want you to understand that the situation in Russia is—it's not black and white. It's quite complex, and it's constantly changing. But these changes—it doesn't look like they have any chance of happening overnight. It's quite clear that the landscape began to change, there is more feeling in the society that people are fed up with the system. They still support the individuals which are on top of the system, but who knows how long this is going to last, because there is basically not very much hope for significant breakthroughs or improvements in sight, and I don't believe that this modernization talk can be taken very seriously. So I think this fed up feeling would continue to grow. I think it's going to be a big question whether finally the Russian society, the Russian people, would become a player in this equation, which they haven't been, because we have been discussing Putin or Medvedev, Medvedev or Ivanov, Medvedev or Putin. I think we need something else in this equation. We need the people finally to have their say. We in the opposition basically try our best to bring the people into that play as an active participants. Of course, we face many problems. Part of them is associated with the information blockade that we are facing by the authorities, but part is associated with our own inertia and inefficiency, which basically is dating back to the old approaches of the opposition parties, which were more in love with the federal television channels or the Kremlin, or some Western human rights organizations and giving speeches in Washington, D.C., rather than going to the Russian regions, meeting with people, appealing to grassroots and so on. So change is a word for which there is a desperate demand, not only in the country in general, but in the opposition in particular. So I am one of the constant advocates for the opposition to change and to be more relevant to the demands of the Russian people. But I still think the recent couple of years give me some optimism in this regard. And I think we were able to achieve something. We were able to invent new approaches. We were able to reach out directly to Russians and broaden the circle of people who listen to us and support us. And this gives some hope. I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about is that, of course, the present system in Russia will last for some more time. Nothing sensational will happen in 2011 or 2012. But I think we are on the edge of the situation where this system will be severely challenged, not only by its inability to seriously move Russia towards modernization, but also by increasing activity of the Russian society, which would indeed express its discontent and the need for a change. I think I've had a very long speech. Sorry, I promised to be short. I completely broken it up, but I think I'll leave this for Q&A. Thank you.
Vladimir, thanks. That was a terrific opening presentation, which is going to generate lots of questions and comments. Very, very insightful and actually I thought quite concise and to the point. And comprehensive. So I don't think you should be apologizing for speaking too long at all. I'll take the prerogative of the chair, and I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask you first. I have to say, though, I was 2 weeks ago I was in St. Petersburg for the International Economic Forum, and I was hoping to get find a copy of your book. But there were none in sight anywhere from what I could tell. Not surprising, but in a way just sort of a remarkable sign of the insecurity of the authorities that they felt that this book should not be circulated amongst meeting of international investors and whatnot. Pretty pathetic, in my view. Overall, my analysis is very, 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 very close to yours. And in the book that Sergei Guriev and Anders Osland and I just edited, came out earlier this month, conclusion is essentially the same. The system can manage in the short term, but it's unsustainable in the long term, and not clear how you get from here to there. My two questions, one. I think you're right to focus on regional elections as a possible avenue. The other thing that strikes me is, and I'd like to hear you talk about, is how effectively do you think that you and the opposition movement are using new communication technologies, and how useful of an avenue is that to for your enlightenment exercises. The second question we had a very interesting discussion over at the American Enterprise Institute yesterday about Hodorkovsky. Peter Baker and Susan Glasser of an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy called The Billionaire Dissident, which I highly recommend if anyone hasn't read yet. And I was wondering, it's interesting that there another trial is going on, the charges in this case are even more ridiculous and absurd than the charges in the first case. In my view, the arrest and the sentencing of Hodorkovsky was the most significant, my personal view, the most significant event, political event, in the last decade. And what would happen to him if a different outcome were to take place in this trial than what the conventional wisdom expects, i.e., that he will rot in jail for a lot longer. I think that would similarly be a landmark, a watershed. And it seems that the authorities aren't quite sure what to do. It was interesting to see that Greff and Hristienka testified, and their testimony was, I'd say, ambivalent at best from the standpoint of making the case. Do you see any opportunity? How do you see this playing out? And then I'll open it up to for others.
Well, briefly about the brochure and seizure. Of course, the authorities they have read it, and Putin have read it most definitely. And the whole purpose of this brochure was to make an assault on Putin's popular approval rating. I wouldn't hide. Our ultimate goal is to destroy Putin's approval rating, to disclose the truth about the results of his activity as president and prime minister, and to open people's eyes. And the authorities pretty much get it. And I also have to say that Putin's popular approval rating has been the one pillar on which the current political system has been founded on in the recent years. So this is why, of course, they see it dangerous for themselves if the people read this brochure. This is why this is not Lushkov. We have been allowed to distribute the anti-Lushkov brochure relatively freely, with some problems, but relatively freely. And I think we did expect it. This did not came unexpected at all. We just missed the forum opportunity. But yet we will distribute it. And particularly back to your second question, we will, of course, use different technologies. I'd say that the problem with Russian regions is that they're not particularly technologically advanced, and the government is intentionally containing the process. Despite talk of the modernization, the government had officially postponed the federal program, which was aimed at developing broadband internet connections in the Russian regions. There was such a federal program, but the Ministry of Information Technology, Shigalkov, had made an official decision to postpone its implementation beyond 2012. Obviously, for one simple purpose, because deeper penetration of internet raises interest in relatively free political internet in Russia, and this is something which the authorities don't want. So I'll just give you a couple of numbers. When we had participated, or our whole team in Sochi mayor elections, helping Nemtsov to run last year, Sochi has like 300,000 registered voters. And of them, only around 30, 40,000 people are internet users, of which I'd say less than 10,000 are more or less frequent users of web news resources and political internet. So 10,000 out of 300,000, this is the audience. I think this proportion, and this is Sochi. It's not Urupinsk. This is one of the, what people might think, advanced cities in Russia. So, to reach out to grassroots and to regional audiences, it doesn't even take, you know, the sophisticated use of modern technique as much as it takes development of some communication technologies with finding the right people, connectors, who can help you really distribute your ideas and reach out people all over the region. and basically stimulate the grassroots activity of the civil society there. It's a very painfully slow process, particularly for the opposition totally lacking skills for that. And the whole concept of opposition in the previous years was that it should basically sit inside the garden ring and hire some people for money who would solve the problems in the regions. It just doesn't work that way anymore. This is why, actually, what we have been having a discussion about whether we should or should not appeal to Ministry of Justice with an attempt to register a new liberal democratic political party. Now, in this regard, my argument is that it's not about whether we should or not approach Ministry of Justice, but that the previous approaches were based on the concept that, look, we have like up to 1,000 real activists of some political party, and then we find some 50,000 just people who in one way or another sign the documents that they are ready to participate. Now, my point is that we need to find a network of 50,000 active supporters of democratic opposition ready to devote their resources and participate in political opposition activity, which is possible, I have to say. And if we do that, and if we have a relatively wide regional coverage in that, that means that the question of these 50,000 people really getting together and going to the Ministry of Justice to demand formal registration, that would be a totally different story than if you are Kasyanov's party with relatively small number of real active members and the majority of people who just signed the documents that they want to participate. If we're going to have a real 50,000 activists all over the country, which is possible and achievable, that would be crucial in terms of achieving our goals in distributing information, participating in elections, and coordinating other opposition activities. And that would make a difference in terms of the attitude of the authorities towards registration of a new potential liberal party. Now, with Khodorkovsky, and you're pretty much aware of the fact that this is a very personal vendetta. This is a very personal case for Vladimir Putin. So I think this is the main factor which shapes it all. And I know that a lot of people in the authorities basically realize the absurdity of this whole case. Even Grief and Christianka, I say Grief and Christianka, and I can tell you this from my personal knowledge. I did communicate with both a lot when I used to work in the government. These are not the people who have a particularly favorable view of Khodorkovsky. Never had. But even they realize the absurdity of the case, I believe. There is more and more recognition, indirect recognition of that. But everybody understands at the same time that this is a personal case of Vladimir Putin. So to be able to suggest, imagine you're President Medvedev or whoever influential of that sort, to be able to suggest that, to go on Putin to suggest, look, Vladimir Vladimirovich, we need to release this guy because it's getting more and more absurd, is equal to personally confronting Putin, because everybody knows that his personal motivations and interests are deeply involved in the case. This is why I'm skeptical on any positive developments of the case. Of course, I have all the hopes that Khodorkovsky is released as soon as possible, and I would do my best to help it, but the problem is that I think it's really hitting the wall of Putin's personal attitude, which is, to me, not changing. Recent visits of Grief and Christianka, many people who want to be optimistic about Khodorkovsky's perspective had really interpreted this as a sign of a potential change of the attitude toward the case. You know, if you take a look at what really happened, I see it more as a freak occurrence, if you will, rather than just one of those cases, rather than some kind of a staged attempt of a more liberal group within the authorities to finally make a step towards release of the Khodorkovsky? No, I don't think so. I think that it was a very successful move of Khodorkovsky's defense to demand testimonies of these witnesses. And I think the authorities and the judge were caught up in a very unpleasant situation, because if they didn't go and didn't testify, it really would have been one more brick in the wall of the arguments of those who say that the process is politically staged. So they were kind of forced to go. But at the same time, I think I've carefully read what Grief and Christianka had said. I think they did their best to achieve two different goals. One, not to compromise the official prosecutor's office position on the case. At the same time, not to make themselves look stupid. So they tried their best to pass between this rock and this hard place. It was not necessarily, extremely successful. And I would say that Khodorkovsky's defense and PR people have been extremely successful, on the contrary, in presenting it like Grief and Christianka had actually confirmed that the allegations are absurd. In fact, what they said in reality was not really straightforward that much. And I think that both Grief and Christianka will be able to present the case to Putin like, Volodya, we didn't say too much to compromise your prosecutors. So I think it's just rather a sign of a weakness of this tandem system, because there is not one decision-making center which can say to people, look, ministers, don't go there. I command you. The system of decision-making is really split, and this creates a lot of uncertainty, and this forces members of establishment, bureaucrats like Grief or Christianka, to kind of maneuver in between the situation. I think what have been happening during their visit and testimonies is can be characterized by one word, is maneuvering, not really knowing. So they were not, of course, by all means, they were not supporting Khodorkovsky, but they were, quite flexible in terms of giving commands the official suggestion. So I would like to take this as a sign for a change, but frankly, I don't see enough reasons for it.
Excellent. Let's open the floor. Please identify yourself for Lydia.
John Squire from the National Endowment for Democracy. Hi, Vladimir. It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
I'd like to turn towards the topic of corruption again, because that's the one area of your book that I actually did not find all that convincing in terms of being a particularly damning indictment of the Putin regime. When you look at the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index, what you find is that actually there hasn't been much change in Russia's position relative to other countries. It's been at around the 80th percentile for the past 10 years. And in fact, you mentioned that Russia's now on a level with Ecuador, but in 1999, which was the first year they published that index, Russia was on the exact same level as Ecuador as it was in the 2009 index. Second, having lived in Russia in the 1990s and seeing what was going on, I'm not so clear that what's going on today and what went on back then is, in terms of corruption, is so spectacularly different. In some respects, in the sense that people aren't getting gunned down on Pushkin Square anymore, it might actually be described as a somewhat improved situation. So I'm wondering if you could address that point in general. A second thing that I'd like to bring up is, we hear a lot about how the system in Russia is unsustainable. But unsustainable systems seem to have an ability to persist in Russia for quite a long time. And features of that unsustainability, such as corruption, seem to persist over very long stretches and over several different political orders, I guess you'd call them. So my question is, what's different this time? What's going to motivate people to really take action against an aspect of the system like corruption that they've been seeing for a long time. What in particular is going to motivate that or make that possible? Thanks.
Shall we collect more, or shall I just answer? Okay.
Why don't you answer that?
Yeah, sure. So about corruption, I think I take your arguments, but I think it's wrong. This is my critical view of most of the critics of this corruption chapter. They focus on the Transparency International part of it, which is just one paragraph, or two maybe. And there's a big chapter. And again, I have in my speech, I have listed many features of many parameters of the analysis of corruption, which is increasingly tied conflict of interest, which became established, which was not the case in the end of the 90s, because Baturina started her active business in construction, receiving benefits from Lushkov starting from 2000s, not in the 90s. She was not active as a real estate developer during the 90s. And in the 90s, we didn't have. We had Yeltsin family, yes, of course. We had loans for shares, but we didn't have all these massive institutionalized conflicts of interest everywhere. Like when we had something which didn't make it to the report because we want to keep it condensed, for instance, when we had this catastrophe on Sayano-Shushenskaya hydropower station, it soon made it to the newspapers, became evident that one big firm, which was receiving contracts for repairs of equipment there, is owned by the father of Mr. Voskresensky, Deputy Minister of Economy, who is directly responsible for tariff regulation for Sayano-Shushenskaya hydropower station. And this company was taking contracts and not doing its job properly. And, I mean, there's plenty of this relative connections here and there. So the conflict of interest is one thing. Second, which makes it drastically different from the 90s, nothing comparable, is the size of the government. Because we didn't have this multi-billion dollar projects, which we mentioned, and there is a specific several paragraphs on that and a specific chapter on this mega projects. The more spending had increased, particularly on these investment projects, the more government became drowning in corruption related to that. In the 90s, the whole idea was to reduce the size of the government, which was one primitive but sure way of fighting corruption as which concerning the redistribution of state resources. What we also do is we address a very painful issue of a skyrocketing, a doubling of number of recorded bribery cases, multiplied by the fact that according to the official, this is what we actually mentioned in the report, according to the official statistics of the Russian Supreme Court, the chairman of Supreme Court, Lebedev, had voiced that, about 65% of cases on bribery that make it to the court end up with acquittance of people who are charged, which is a drastically different number of acquittance sentences that you see in other cases against ordinary people, which is close to 1% instead, not 65%. So I wouldn't go so far. Just one argument, dramatically increased size of the government, basically, I think, destroys the argument that it is pretty much the same in the 90s. Because the size of the government in the 90s was a small fraction of what we have right now. Basically, the regulatory powers of the government have increased significantly. The spending have increased as a share of GDP had increased significantly. The GDP itself had increased significantly. We're operating on with totally different sums. And there is a totally different system of institutionalization of conflicts of interest. This is what we say. And we also list a number of very, very murky cases for which we still didn't have answers. Where's the 6% of shares of Gazprom? Who's behind Rosukrenergo? How did the sales of Gazprom Bank, Gazfond, and SoGas Insurance Company went? How did the non-core assets of Gazprom ended up in the hands of Kovalchuk? Who is behind Ganvor? We have stated these questions in the first report released more than 2 years ago. We didn't get the answers. And at least I'm not advocating the murky procedures of the 90s, but at least in the loans for shares auctions, they were completely unfair and non-transparent, but at least you knew what money was taken and where, in which pockets it went and who became the ultimate owner of the assets. But right now it's completely unknown. So this Ecuador and transparency index thing in this regard, it's just a one more illustration that, yes, we're in deep morass regarding corruption. And I think it's people pick up too much on this Transparency International point, but it's obviously more than that. And sorry, there was another point of your question, which I don't...
Public response.
What makes it different this time in terms of public response? What's going to change people's opinion when this kind of thing has persisted for such a long time?
There's this whole idea which have been dominating the Russian political discourse during a long period of time, that basically people are not supporting any kind of change because they very much like the system which we have built. Now, what I've been talking about and what we, I think, have seen many proofs of is that they don't. And the support of the system as such is negligent. People generally, you can see this sparked in massive protests of election outcomes, people generally start to very much dislike the system that we had to build. They continue to like certain individuals, which to me, this gap is just a matter of time to overcome. Bring the individuals to the accountability for the negative system that they've built. So there are more signs that even from ordinary people to even members of the establishment in large numbers want this system to change somehow. This is why I'm not advocating some quick, rapid and radical scenario that we're going to have democratic change and Russia would return back to normal in a couple of years because all of the nation would protest. No, it's not going to happen that way. What I'm saying is that there are clear signs, regional elections, mass protests, general public opinion, which indicate that the support for the system is largely gone, despite the remaining support of the individuals. And I'm not going to play with the word sustainable or not sustainable. It's quite clear that the system is not sustainable. And I take your correct point that Russia, not only Russia, has the ability to hang on for a while being in a non-sustainable situation, which is very correct. But I said that the big shift of the recent couple of years is that because of the social contract between Putin and the society, which was not breached by the authorities, life really has been improving somehow. People did really like the system that was built. That's not true anymore. So I think it is a stage for a big shift. And again, I'm not saying this shift is going to be fast, but it's a slow process, but it works. This is what I said.
Don, Jim, Len, sorry, John, yes. Don, collect a few comments.
Don Jensen, Johns Hopkins, thanks for your comments. Catherine Belton in the Financial Times this week had what appeared to be an interview with Sechin and a long discussion about their role in the system. Could you say a little bit more about, I don't like to use the phrase, but I will, Siloviki, divided as they are, what role do they still play? Are they quieter? Are they tamer? Or I very much appreciate your comments.
We'll collect a few right
now. Yeah. Jim.
Thank you.
John, then
I'm Jim Symington, with the chairman of the American Russian Cultural Foundation here. And I'm concerned, wonder what the academic community, what role they have in preparing young Russians for their future, the role of universities, maybe the secondary schools. For example, if you were to appear before a group of students, would what you're saying be understandable by them, appreciated or questioned or rejected? Because we're the present leads to the future, and those kids are going to be part of that future. So I just wondered how that's developing.
Okay, another good question. John, here. There's a microphone you can use right in front of you. And then Lana, then we'll give you a chance to respond.
John Milhone, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My interest, as yours has been in the role of energy and the changes that are taking place. And I see the role of energy for Russia as being largely behind the economic prosperity of the past decade, and the limitations in that capacity in the future as being an important driver for change. The energy changes affect the regions, districts in different way. And I'm curious about your thoughts about whether this hypothesis is correct, and if so, which of the regions in Russia are more likely to be those that are more responsive to the kind of inspiration that you're trying to give.
See you again, Vlad, in your new role. First of all, I want to commend you for your innovative approach for mobilizing the opposition and wish you a lot of success in that area. I actually have two questions. Besides corruption, what is the opposition proposing to the Russian society as a means for to move towards a non-Putin government? And also, there have been some Russians who said that even though Putin is very popular, there now appears to be Putin fatigue in Russia. And what's your reaction to that?
Okay, Siloviki, education.
Yes. Well, Siloviki. First, I think it's important to understand that this whole concept of Siloviki is, it has a lot of mythology and exaggeration attached to it, but it has a lot of relevance either. Important fact, which I would start with, is that After Putin stepping down from presidential position and this new balance of power achieved with Medvedev's presidency, it's important to understand that Putin had very seriously downgraded a lot of prominent members of the Siloviki clan who has been outspoken before. For instance, Patrushev has been removed from FSB to really he's still a member of the clan, but he was moved to a more ceremonial position. Cherkesov was moved either further away, and very recently Medvedev had signed a decree on resignation of him. And, you know, the rivalry between Patrushev and Cherkesov was nearly the main intrigue among the Siloviki clan during 8 years of Putin's presidency. Sergei Ivanov basically disappeared out of sight. Viktor Ivanov was important and influential presidential aide on personal appointments issues, and he was moved to the Narcotics Committee, which really has still important but really has a secondary role. And Medvedev actually did a lot to destroy Viktor Ivanov's legacy in terms of personal appointment policy. For instance, Ivanov has been blocking in mass the appointment of new judges. Medvedev had basically unblocked that.
And, Viktor Ivanov.
Yes, Viktor Ivanov, yeah. That was the only couple of people who have been able to somewhat maintain their positions are Sechin and Chemezov. I'd say there are also it's also problematic because Sechin, yeah, he's exposed he's on very practical issues right now, very important, including energy, industrial policy. But being a deputy prime minister is very much not the same as being deputy head of presidential administration. As the deputy head of presidential administration, you can call, let's say, prosecutor general and say, prosecutor general, I ask you to do something for me. And prosecutor general will be forced to somewhat respond. And if you are deputy prime minister, even if your name is Sechin and even if your boss is Putin, it's much more difficult to do that. So it was, with more exposure and with some really important issues at hand, but Sechin was still downgraded. Not even to mention Chemezov, who's in deep trouble right now because his corporation, Rostechnologie, is in deep economic and financial trouble. And Chemizov, I think, became one of the major points of attack by President Medvedev, with whom they have somewhat difficult relationship. So, you know, and there's this somewhat new group of Siloviki, like Bortnikov or Nurgaliyev, or Serdyukov, the Minister of Defense, which currently occupy very important posts, but they don't have that much of the insider influence or public exposure as the previous Siloviki clan did. So, you know, I would say that if we talk about what's the difference with 5 years in retrospective, is that then the so-called Siloviki clan was much stronger and much more, publicly determined for some kind, had some kind of vision, policy, or let's say collective interest, even though there was rivalry too. Than right now. It's far less organized and far weaker now. So if you're asking about what their role going to be in the future transfer of power, I'd say that right now it looks more than this Siloviki clan is far more Putin-centric than it was ever before. Because, let's say, 5 years ago, certain of these people seemed a bit more equal to Putin than they are now. Right now, Putin's supremacy in this segment of the Siloviki segment of the Russian establishment had substantially increased. So he's the heavyweight. And what these guys think matters much less than some time ago. Now, about the universities. First, I have to say, and I have commented, I have been asked many questions in Washington this time about how we deal with Russian youth. And the unfortunate answer, not only from my part, but from Oleg Kozlovsky, who was joining me, the other member of the opposition who was joining me for many meetings in the recent couple of days, was that we are not particularly optimistic about the current Russian youth, people aged from 18 to 25. It looks like we have, which is one of the real faults, I think, of the 90s as well. There is a much more cynical generation growing up in Russia, which has, you know, there's been a lot of opinion polling about what's the dream of the Russian youth. And great majority answer something like they want to work in Gazprom. Which is an illustration of the fact that for this young generation, the risk and opportunity mentality is not something they embrace. They want to have a safe haven in one of these state-affiliated and state-financed corporations with a clear career path of moving from one position to another. Basically very, very similar to the army scheme or whatever vertical bureaucratic scheme you can imagine. This doesn't concern all of the young people. There are a lot of very prospective, very bright young people in Russia, but generally, my assessment is that as far as the opposition is concerned, I'd put more hope in the generation aged from 30 to 50, which are people who have seen Soviet Union and have no illusion about what it was in reality, because believe me, there is an enormous number of young people who think that Soviet Union was a kind of a lost paradise, which was destroyed with the help of the CIA and whatever institutions have generously contributed to that process. And when you start to tell them that, you know, I'm one of the most anti-Soviet persons in the Russian politics right now, I would demand the credit like that. I'm engaged in many discussions about that issue. And, you know, when you come up with some memories that people in the Soviet Union were searching the stores to buy large amounts of soap or salt or matches to be able to store at homes because they were not sure that they will be able to get it anytime soon. People just don't believe it. You know, some people in the internet forums right now even argue that Soviet Union had modern computers, which literally, you can read it on my internet live journal blog. Yeah, sure. So this Soviet renaissance and mythology and discourse is very, very popular with young generation. A lot of people, actually, they love wear T-shirts with this Soviet symbols and so on. And I'd say, and there's this, on one hand, nostalgia for something they never knew. On the other hand, a lot of cynicism and a lack of this ideological motivation and desire to change the country for the better. Just, you know, focus on some plain personal benefits. I'd say maybe the next generation will be better. I think it's the father and son's conflict, maybe.
As a vocation, I would imagine that aspirations to work in the intelligence services have taken a hit this week.
Yeah. Well, speaking about that, Andy, I'm convinced that what have happened is probably the United States have uncovered some kind of a secret conspiracy to strip SVR budget, pretending that people are doing this espionage job in the U.S. Wherein this is how Russian corruption works this day. They invent a project.
It's a jobs program.
And they did not spy on anything in reality. But, you know, yeah, it's a job. Anti-crisis job creation program, I think. So back to the youth question. We try to work with universities, but a lot of them are under tight control of the authorities. That's the major problem. We really have difficulties in arranging meetings inside the universities. And the great majority of university leadership is against providing floor to the opposition. So really, the university system as such is not helpful in that in general. And there is a great political pressure. Even some of the university heads are more liberal and more open for providing floor to us, but they experience tremendous pressure from the authorities with purpose not to allow us to speak. So we are, you know, looking for, I think, different techniques, I would have to say, are more effective. Distributing our brochures, newspapers, and reaching out on the internet and the remaining independent media, there's still a lot in the regions. From one region to another, you find here and there a lot of independent media sources. It's difficult for them to survive, and this field is shrinking, but it still exists, and it's very important for us. So this youth and university thing is important, but it's not that promising as it could have been. Now, energy, I have to say that it was on the edge of the policy shift during the recent decade from opening up and privatization towards greater state interference and nationalization. This did not contribute to broader investment and development. This had scared off international direct investments in the energy, which had postponed development of new greenfield potential. And this is still a big problem right now. And I think another big problem, which is a very current development and very shocking, is that the centralized vertical approaches to marketing of Russian energy resources on international markets have turned out to be outdated. I'm particularly speaking about Gazprom and the European gas situation. They have completely overslept a sharp jump in competition from LNG imported from elsewhere. They have completely overslept the U.S. shale gas developments as an important thing for the European energy market, because the LNG that is not currently in demand in the U.S. because of the shale gas, where does it go? It goes to Europe. And and they're still sticking quite carelessly to this long-term take-or-pay contracts and price formulas linked to oil, whereas it leads to a situation where you can have imported LNG in Zeebrugge costing $170 per 1,000 cubic meters and Gazprom's gas in Austria $300,000. Now, who would buy that? They're still, despite all this evidence, they're fiercely defending the old system, and which basically undermines their non-competitiveness in even in the medium-term run. And if Europe starts to develop shale gas in Poland or in areas where it's possible, I'd say which would be an important marginal component for the European gas market. I don't see that centralized planning approach, which became the champion of policy in the energy area in the recent years, I don't see that delivers success anywhere, in upstream, downstream, and so on. So whatever happens, it's quite clear that the energy sector will not be a driver of growth anymore. It's in big trouble right now, and we need complete change of policies to somewhat reassure it and make it work. Lena, I'm sorry, I think I've forgotten your sorry. Yeah, the regional impact. In terms of influence on the Russian regions, I have to say that there is an extremely uneven distribution of resources, and most of the production of oil and gas, for instance, is very clearly located in very few regions, which is north of Tumen region, which is Timana-Pechora, which is North Caspian, I think, would be developing quite significantly and would add to economic benefits of regions associated with it. But that's largely it. And Sakhalin, of course. And if we speak about Eastern Siberian potential, I have to say that it's, to me, largely overestimated. There's much ado about nothing. There's less oil in Eastern Siberia than in either Timana-Pechora or North Caspian regions, which are each of them individually much more promising than the whole this big part of mountainous terrain where you don't find oil in Switzerland, as they say. So there's much less oil in Eastern Siberia than the noise about it. So I'd say this factor is not really that important for in terms of regional development. Most of the Russian regions don't have the advantage of being resource rich, and even those who are basically fell hostages of the system of broader redistribution of resources, financial resources, and benefits towards the federal center, the Ministry of Finance, Kudrin. So therefore, it is the Ministry of Finance which accumulates most of the wealth. So therefore, I think this gives a chance for more or less even distribution of problems all over the country, particularly regional budget deficits, which is the problem that is quite actual even for resource-rich regions, simply because of the redistribution. Sorry, Lena, just...
It had to do with Putin fatigue. Last question. If I could add one more question to the table, because we're virtually out of time.
Yeah.
What is it that you're advising for us to do? Please address Lena's question.
The Putin fatigue. I still think that, I confirm that Putin remains quite a popular figure in Russia, mainly because, and this relates to your question about what opposition is offering as an alternative, because he's seen as the man of action, despite all, a lot of people are pretty aware of certain faults of his, but still he's seen as the person who comes and does something while others talk. This is why it's very important for us to overcome the myth that we haven't anything to offer as an alternative, because yes, we can. We have been developing, we have 2 years ago published a comprehensive program called 300 Steps to Freedom. It was a program of the Solidarity Movement, which had been addressing multiple issues from transfer to professional army to pension reform. Well, pension reform is one of the dramatic failures of the current system, and we do offer a totally different approach, a creation of a Russian national pension fund which would accumulate oil and gas revenues and revenues from privatization and earnings from the use of the state property, which are right now just used for general spending, to cover general spending of the budget, but we want to have a purpose use of this money, particularly to create a normal modern pension system. So we do have a lot to say, and I think this is why the most important task for us today is to overcome that perception that besides Putin, no one can really address the actual problems of Russia. No one can offer the solutions. Yes, we can. And I think this relates to your last question, Andy, what you can do. I was strongly encouraging people. The frequency of with which this question have been asked somewhat scares me, because a lot of people say it with an attitude like, look, where's my 44 Magnum? I want to help. And the Obama administration is not doing enough to support the human rights in Russia. Now, that scares me a bit, because there's not much the West can do. I became deeply convinced with my experience in Russian politics that if the situation can be changed, the change should come from within, not from without. And I'm against, I think, the direct interference in our politics would be counterproductive. It's our job. And we already have had too much and continue to have problems with being accused of being CIA spies, so that we don't need additional help. And we don't need more backup in this. So I think what is important is that, and for instance, some people argue that there is a need to issue more statements if something is violated in Russia. Look, even as we speak, every 15 seconds something serious is violated in Russia, or if more frequently. And the frequency of statements basically is reversely proportional to the effectiveness of this. Like when I was a couple of times in the police custody arresting at some non-sanctioned street protest, I think some statements have been issued. I didn't really know this because it was not really particularly helpful. And I can handle the Russian police, you know. I don't need help from Washington to do that. So I think what is more important is that there is a lot of democratic infrastructure in Russia, particularly independent media, or certain regional civil society structures, NGOs, which do a lot of useful work in terms of enlightening people and bringing civil activists together. This is not related necessarily to any specific political force, and this democratic infrastructure is in terrible need of support. Organizational training, other forms of support, and I think this should become the priority focus for those Western countries who are concerned with development of civil society and democracy in Russia. I think it's no use really speaking about the direct support and interconnection between the West and certain political forces in Russia. Let's develop the infrastructure, the floor for everybody to promote that free discussion, exchange of opinion, and free democratic process as one means to bring the accountability to the governance. Thank you.
Vlad, two conclusions. One, I completely agree with you that at the minimum what we should do is follow the Hippocratic Oath and do no harm for you and your colleagues. Secondly, I do have problems sometimes with the Russian police, and so next time I do, I'm going to give you a call. you can handle them, because I don't handle them too well. No, but seriously, thank you very, very much for sharing your really insightful thoughts today with us about many, many issues in Russia, and we look forward to seeing you again here sometime in the not-too-distant future in Washington, and you always have a venue, open venue here to come and speak. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. For more, please visit csis.org.